session number 8329, reel 2.
Charles Willis, reel 2.
Mm-hmm.
You were talking about signalling.
Well, you meant if an aircraft was in distress, so it had to be ditched and so on. Oh, yes, in the war, there's very much many systems for alerting other people, particularly the Coastal Command vessels are always flying over the sea. They had a thing, I forget the name of it, but it was a box of tricks which they took with them. If they ditched, they could get this thing into a dinghy and wind a handle and send out a continuous SOS signal, and usually that could be picked up. It was on a standard international frequency and it was invariably picked up. And then they even had a kite to fly an aerial, and I brought one of those kites out of the service with me, which the children now have. I don't know whether that was illegal or not, but most of us took an old kite out of the service. And the children fly it now. So there were many systems. A local system, if an aircraft is in distress in the circuit around an aerodrome, he could always fire a red, they were known as Vary pistols in those days, so he could always fire off a red flare, a cartridge. And this was like a ball of fire going into the air, red, and it was easily seen, and one would then give them a priority on landing and get the ambulances out and certainly help them. Also, there was the WT operator. In the case of large aircraft, the WT operators would send out a signal. And in the case of fighter aircraft, well, they had a VHF system, especially later in the war when they had VHF as against HF. They were in continuous touch with the ground station anyway. So if they were, even if they were shot, they could say they could usually get something out. Unless they were blown up. So there was many systems, and as I say, you had an ordinary red signal, you had radio RT and WT, and if you ditched, you had, if you were flying over the water and you ditched, you had methods of flotation and getting out of an aircraft, and emergency panels could be broken, and they could, if they weren't too badly injured, they could send off some form of SOS, certainly. Yeah. So it's all that was going in the war, very much so.
During the war, whilst you were training, did you operate from the same base, or were you moved around?
Oh, I moved around, because I was first of all training on a reserve school at Gravesend before the war. And then after that, when the war came, I went through the CFS, that's the Central Flying School for upgrading your instructional work. That was at Uphaven. And then from there I went to Lossiemouth in Scotland. And I was training at Lossiemouth for a long time. Then after Lossiemouth in Mauritia, I went down to an aerodrome called Kidlington, I think, near Oxford. And I was instructing there. And then from there, when I went to an OTU, I was at Church Fenton, which is near York, I think. Church Fenton. And then when I went to 24 Squadron, my headquarters was based at Hendon, right near London. And that was the headquarters. But we have several units which we placed around the place. We had one at Port Reith, where we used to dispatch aircraft over the Atlantic and down into the Mediterranean and around generally. Aircraft were dispatched abroad there, and then we had a base unit, I think we call it, or a section or something down in it wasn't as big as a flight, but it was mainly just to maintain the aeroplane, to do servicing as the aircraft went through. We had a base at Gibraltar, and then we later had one at after the North African invasion, I think it was, we had one at Algiers, a place called Maison Blanche in Algiers, in the Provence of Algeria. Then we were engaged in the Malta nonsense, but we ultimately had a base. We might have had a temporary base just in one or two places. And we might have had one at Cairo West for a short time while we were doing some work there. And then I think we ultimately, after the siege of Malta, we had a base at Malta for a time, and so on.
What were living accommodation like at
the time? Well, it was known as transit accommodation. When we were in the UK, the living accommodation at Hendon was very good. I mean, it was just normal Royal Air Force messing, which was quite good. Then as we went further away, Portreath was more or less tin huts. And as we went to Gibraltar, once again it was tin huts, but a bit more dusty and a bit more flies and things like that. And then in places like Algeria, well, it was pretty rough. It was camping, you know, it was more or less camping accommodation. And it was a bit sandy and a bit rough. And so it was at Cairo. Although when I was in Cairo, I stayed at a hotel called Shepherd's, because I was privileged, because I was a sort of senior captain. I went to Shepherd's Hotel, and I had a hotel accommodation. But I have an idea Shepherd's was burnt down or something after the war. Don't think it's there now.
What were relations like between the officers and men at the
camp? Oh, very good. Oh, yeah, very good. Now, the relations with our squadron between... I was a flight commander. I commanded B Flight, 24 Squadron. And as a flight commander, I was quite well respected, and the men respected you, certainly, and they did their job, and your relationship was quite good. And we had automatic systems for instance, at Christmas time, all the officers, if we were back at base, all the officers served all the airmen and everybody with their Christmas dinner, so the airmen had a treat, you see. And then we frequently went to the sergeant's mess and drank a few drinks with them at times and various functions. And when I was at Lossiemouth, we did a play. We did a play. What do you call it? What do you call the society when you do plays?
A dramatic society
sort of thing we formed just to do a play or two. And we were all involved in that, airmen, NCOs, and officers. We were all involved in that. So, our relationship with the men was excellent, really.
What about discipline?
Well, there was a written in discipline because there was a thing called the King's Regulations, and we all abided by the King's Regulations, and you had the King's Regulations behind you. I mean, if the men misbehaved themselves in some way or another, either negligent with their work or they... didn't come back from leave and the various things that they would be up on a charge for, they were brought up before, in many cases brought up before me, because I was a flight commander, and I had powers up to a certain level only. Beyond that, I'd refer them to the station commander or even the court martial if necessary. But generally speaking, I only did the sort of more minor charges, you know, late back from leave or getting tired or doing something they shouldn't have done. But that didn't disrupt relations at all, because they knew jolly well they'd transgressed and they were going to be punished. They knew it.
Did you have to recommend any for court-martial?
I didn't personally, no. It didn't come my way, because most of our air crew were all experienced, because we didn't have any inexperienced air crew in our squadron, because they'd all come from other avenues, because we had to have... a pretty experienced lot, because we were flying ministers of the crown, and we were flying important people, including the prime minister and monarchs, and we flew the king, and we flew many other monarchs. I mean, I alone flew people like King George II of the Hellenes and King Peter. I went out and got them out of their trouble, and I flew members of the royal family like Duke of Gloucester and the Princess Royal and many. So. We had to obviously have a top performance all the time. There was no question of anything going wrong.
This is when you were in 24 Squadron.
This is when I was in 24 Squadron.
Could you tell me how you were promoted to this squadron?
This squadron? Well, I'd finished my tour of duty, you see. I'd finished a tour of duty in training command, and after a year it's reasonable to say that, I've been training all this time, can I progress? And the answer was, yes, you can go to something a bit tougher if you want to. You can go and train at an OTU, which I did. So I was training at an OTU, which was fairly hairy, really. And then after that, I did a tour of duty there. It was reasonable for me to say, well, now can I get to a squadron, you see? And they said, well, you're a much older pilot. I mean, I was over 30. and with your experience, we're not going to send you to a bomber squadron, you're too old to go to a fighter squadron, we'll have to send you to a special duty squadron, which is 24 squadron, where my experience and my aptitude would, and also being commercially licensed helped, because it meant that I had double qualifications. You see, I had a service rating as a pilot and so on, and I had a civil one, so they like people like that in 24 Squadron, because it gave the powers to be a second string in their argument, that if there were ever an accident of any sort, they can say, ah, but he was very experienced, he had this and that and that. So it let them off the hook, you see. So a lot of senior people in the Air Force didn't want to be responsible for putting inexperienced people on advanced work, so they were pretty careful in who they selected. And ultimately, when it became my turn, when I was a flight commander, 24 Squadron, which is a position next to the CO, you see, it meant that when the pilots I chose and accepted in my flight were people of experience. Mind you, they didn't all have all that experience, but they certainly had enough to do the job, you see.
Had you heard of 24 Squadron before?
Oh, yes, I knew 24 Squadron before the war. It was always based at Hindon for many years, and it was a fairly famous squadron. It isn't written up very much or known very much, because their operational work was not spectacular. You see, a lot of work in squadrons was spectacular. I mean, a typical one would be squadrons that shot down a lot of Germans, or squadrons that did things like the dam busting and so on. They became immortal in their memory of their performance. But you see, 24 Squadron did things pretty modestly, and a lot of it was, nothing was said about it, because we didn't want the enemy to know what we were doing. I mean, it's pretty obvious that if we were operating in the Mediterranean or relieving Malta or something, it had to be pretty quiet, because otherwise the Germans would be there waiting for us. So you see, 24 Squadron, all its work was considered or assessed in a pretty modest tone all the time, and it wasn't signalled, you know, all over the world. We did have quite a bit of responsibility, of course, but and after the war, I believe, there was a book written of 24 Squadron, but I wasn't referred to, and I never even had the book, so, you know, I can't refer to that.
Did you choose to go into this squadron?
Well, yes, I was given the opportunity, and I certainly took it. Actually, what happened was, when I'd finished my tour of duty on my night fighting training, my night fighting instructing, I did have a chance with a fellow who was in the squadron already and very much wanted to get onto night fighting, you see. So at the same time as he made an application to get onto a night fighter squadron, having finished a tour in 24 Squadron, at the same time I applied to go to 24 Squadron. So whether or not that was contingent, I don't know, but it certainly gave me an opportunity, and within a week of applying, I was in 24 Squadron.
Did you have to take any tests?
Yes, when I got there, one or two of the senior captains took me up in an aeroplane. Mind you, I had a record before that, but took me up in an aeroplane just to see how I flew and adapted me maybe to a new aeroplane, and only on one occasion, I think, or two occasions, and after that I wasn't tested anymore. Except I did do a few courses. I did an SBA course. SBA means a standard blind approach, which was a radio controlled approach system which we had in those days, called SBA, and the school for that training was at Prestwick. So I did go to Prestwick and go through that, which I managed to achieve quite well. And then I don't think there was much else, no.
What about medicals?
Well, I had to have a medical every 6 months for my commercial licence, because I kept that going. And I had to have a service medical in the Royal Air Force, the normal period, about every 12 months. But that was done by the local doctor, you know, the station doctor. He just gave me the once over and said, that's all right, press on, rewardless, you know. So we did.
When was it that you actually joined 24 Squadron? Do you remember?
Oh, yes, I could tell you that probably. By looking in my logbook. I don't know where it is now. I believe it's at Abingdon, Excellent Squadron. And I believe they're flying VC-10s. I believe they were engaged in this Falklands and everything else. But just once again, you see, they didn't put it on the news. It wasn't flashed around 40. Said, no, wait a minute, I have to look in this book, I think. 24th Squadron. Flamingo. I'm getting near it. Now, there we are. I think I went to Hendon DH86. It looked as if my first logbook entry was the 27th of September 1941. That's when I first went to 24 Squadron.
And you were put? Were you put immediately into operational duty?
Yes. I went straight on to the general work of the squadron. I see my first flight was 2 hours in a DH-86. And then the next flight was in a thing called a Flamingo, to have a machine. And then I was straight on in. I went up to Prestwick and back and, yeah.
What exactly were the terms of reference of this squadron?
Well, it did have a special reference in King's regulations, in that it was the only squadron in the Royal Air Force that aircraft could be flown by the discretion of the captain, and that no senior officer in the service could stop you or alter your judgment. For instance, it occurred on one occasion when I was flying the Duke of Gloucester from an aerodrome in Wales. The weather was appalling, you know. It was most severe weather. It was heavy rain, low cloud, and so on. And the station commander said, you know, his brother was killed, the Duke of Kent, wasn't it, was killed previously on the same conditions, taking off in bad weather among Welsh mountains, and he said, I recommend you not to fly. And in fact, he said, you're not to fly, you know. But I had to use the paragraph in King's regulations to say, well, under King's regulations, so-and-so, I fly at my discretion, and if I think it's you know, reasonable to fly, I'll fly. And I think he rang my squadron commander at Hendon, and the squadron commander backed me up and said, yes, if he wants to proceed with the flight, he should do so. On that again, it took off in absolutely appalling weather, I agree, and it was, you know, heavy rain and so on, straight into cloud and all that. But on the other hand, it was something which I accepted because I've been doing that quite regularly, and it was not abnormal for me. So those sort of things did occur occasionally when you had to use your thing. But the 24th Squadron certainly was a squadron with certain special flying, what do we call privileges, but flying discretions could be exercised, certainly.
And what were your duties?
In the squadron? Well, as I say, I was a flight commander in a B flight. Not all the time, but I mean, I led up to being a flight commander. That means I commanded a flight, which is usually about 16 to 20 aeroplanes. And I carried out the duties as defined by the Air Council. Whatever they wanted done, we did, you see. And it may be the duties were flying monarchs and cabinet ministers and anybody else, any VIPs, all VVIPs, whatever they call them, around to carry out their duties. They did tours of inspection. I took, you might take Inspector General, if you like, to Iceland to examine all the installations there. We took the Prime Minister to conferences. I personally, for instance, was on the Yalta conference, and I flew all the senior staff there, you know, General Alexander and all sorts of people. I've got a list of who I flew. The duties really were to fly quite important people, people who were concerned in the war effort, to all the conferences and to all their air journeys where it's necessary, take them there by day or by night, precisely to time and precisely to do what had to be done to advance the war. I don't think you can say you know, what are your duties, because if you say what are your duties to a bomber squadron, I suppose you'd say, well, to go and drop bombs on the enemy, and a fighter, well, to shoot down the enemy whenever they come in the way, wherever we can. And the duties of our squadron, I suppose, to fill in all the gaps between all the other squadrons and do all the transportation and all the conferences and all the special flying duties that had to be done outside the normal regular squadrons, which meant, mind you, taking, they weren't all VIPs. I remember taking, at the rush on one occasion, I remember taking half a dozen divers out to Malta to rapidly to attend to a ship which was sunk in the harbour, and they had to get the hatches off quickly and get the food out before it was deteriorated by the water, you know, by the Mediterranean water. I mean, things like that. Anything that turned up suddenly had to be done. I mean, you couldn't ask a bomber squadron to do that or a fighter squadron, could you? So we had a squadron, you see, equipped, which was us, to do pretty well anything that came our way of quite an unusual character sometimes.
What sort of notice would you be given?
Oh, sometimes you were pulled out of bed to fly, you know. Sometimes you had no notice at all. You were, you know, airborne instantly, if possible. Yeah, sometimes it was, you had to get in the air as pretty well as fast as a fighter pilot, sometimes. And that meant getting the aircraft fueled to what for what you wanted it to do, and getting a crew together and getting airborne at pretty rapid notice. But generally speaking, we would have about a day's notice, generally, you know, 1 or 2 days' notice.
And what would you know about the nature of the operation?
Well, sometimes, of course, the captain of the aircraft, especially me as flight commander, had to be consulted, because we had to make sure it was the right aeroplane to do the right job. For instance, I remember when, I think it was Sir Archibald Ball Sinclair, I had to go for some reason to the to the Scilly Isles, for instance. Well, they obviously had to consult a pilot, because it was a question of what type of aeroplane you would land in the Scilly Isles. You couldn't detail a person to do it if it wasn't landable there. I mean, it's a very, very short strip. It was only about 650 yards, and it was uphill and over the top and downhill, you see. So although you could fly a light aeroplane in there, to fly a machine in, a twin-engine aeroplane in, with a passenger like Sir Archibald Sinclair, had to be done with a fair amount of safety and care. So they had to consult the pilots in those cases. So I decided that a good aeroplane to do that job would be the DH Rapide, known in the service as the Dominie, I think we used to call it. But anyway, the DH Rapide, the DH-89. So I flew him down there in the area. Then I went over the Scilly Isles first with the aeroplane and did a landing empty to have a look at it. Then came back, connected him and took him over there, merely because they hadn't landed that type of aeroplane before in that aerodrome. So, you know, just to satisfy people, you took precaution. I don't know, of course, why he had to go there. I think it was something, operational reason. It was, they used to have hurricanes there, actually, a flight of hurricanes, but I think they broke a few landing there. But now, of course, since, I believe the aerodrome's been considerably increased and they can land various aircraft there. In any case, they operate helicopters there now, you see, so they can land anywhere. But in those days, you see, the aerodromes weren't developed all that much, except the new Royal Air Force aerodromes with long runways, typical triangle, you know, three runways, were built all over the place for operational use. But generally, those old civil aerodromes are pretty small.
Would you know who your passengers were?
Always, yes. It was legally required for the captain to know all his the name and have a name and list of all the passengers. And the same as a ship or anything, you know, it goes on the manifesto and so on. And I dare say, for operational reasons, it might be necessary for somebody to carry somebody somewhere without knowing the name, but I never did. I always knew who it was I carried. Because generally you had to receive them and be responsible for them, look after them, take them there and all the rest of it, you know. And bring them back very often. Nearly every case you brought them back as well. But we did all the conferences, you see, and therefore you'd have a passenger list. There were occasions when the passenger's name was not put on the manifesto. They used to put down VVIP and so on, and it was somebody like Churchill. They didn't always put his name on the thing. If there was any risk of perhaps being intercepted or something, and they didn't want it known, or they didn't even want the people to know on the departure point. On one or two occasions they did. I mean, I knew who they were, but they weren't always written down. I mean, I've got some of the old forms here where they just put down VVIP, two VVIPs, and then they put the other names down. They wouldn't disclose. I think that was purely for security reasons. But the captain of the aircraft always knew who he flew. You see.
You flew to Iceland?
Yes, I flew to Iceland, yeah.
What was that about?
Well, we took Iceland over in the wars, you know. The Germans were operating in and out of Iceland with their submarines. They were using Iceland as a submarine base, refueling base and so on. So the War Council, I suppose, decided that we would just kick the Germans out, and all those there we would intern. And so we told the Icelandic people about this, and of course they, I don't know what went on the diplomatic level, but I would say that that they decided that it was not acceptable. I mean, Churchill undoubtedly said it's not acceptable, so we went in there, and it was necessary when we took it over. The Americans and us, we took it over together, although it became a Royal Air Force command. We didn't interfere with the local population or anything, except those who were involved in, say, the military or the naval side of it. The idea was to stop the Germans using it. And so we just went in at the rush. Everybody went in together, the Navy, Air Force, Americans and so on, just went in and locked up any Germans.
What part did the 4th Squadron play in this?
Well, I flew in the people who took the Iceland over. I flew in Air Commodore Wigglesway, was it? He was Air Officer commanding the command. I don't know how I can find it now. It's somewhere in the middle of this logbook. I might be able to find his name, I dare say. Little down with out of the many VIPs I did fly. Yes, Air Commodore Lloyd, an Air Commodore Wigglesworth, an Air Commodore Warren Brown. I took those three in, and they were the senior officers commanding Iceland, so I took in the people who commanded it was known as Iceland Command, I think. That was interesting up to a point. Of course, in Iceland, especially with the equipment we had available, I took them in a Hudson aeroplane. But of course,